This is Law and Disorder.
There have been increasing attacks on Muslims, Arabs, and those mistaken for them in this country. Today we cover the phenomena of Islamophobia.
The Nation magazine did a special issue to its credit, a dozen articles on Islamophobia, where it began, what it's about, and how 9/11 was not the only reason we're seeing these attacks on Muslims in the United States and throughout the world.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. On August 28th, last month, the Haifa High Court announced its verdict in the case of Corey versus the State of Israel. The case had been brought on behalf of Rachel Corey by her parents against Israel for Rachel's killing on March 16, 2003. On that day, Rachel Corey, working with the International Solidarity Movement, a pro-Palestinian movement trying to stop violence against Palestinians, was standing in Rafah, Gaza, trying to prevent the demolition of a house, of a civilian house, where there were young people in the house, including a six-year-old boy. She was standing in front of a bulldozer, a military Caterpillar bulldozer, D9R. As she stood in front of the bulldozer, wearing an orange jacket and with a bullhorn, the bulldozer rode right over her, killing her, I would say murdering her. Despite demands for Israel to do a thorough investigation of her death, no credible investigation was ever done. Interestingly, the U.S. itself said that no credible investigation had been done, that the military investigation was not thorough. There were also two lawsuits brought against Caterpillar and Israel. The first, the Center for Constitutional Rights, represented Rachel Corey and her family against Caterpillar. The claim was pretty straightforward. Caterpillar bulldozers were being sold by Caterpillar to the Israeli Defense Forces, where they were used for illegal purposes and war crimes. Those included the demolition of civilian houses, as well as the killing of civilians who tried to stop those illegal demolitions. The center litigated that case for a couple of years. It finally lost a few years ago, made it to the higher courts in the U.S. The appellate court in the United States decided not to really decide the case, but to punt it by saying that it's none of our business as a court. This is a political decision that has to be made by the president, the executive, and the Congress. The question of selling bulldozers used for war crimes to Israel, a political decision. Well, you can believe that out of the United States because, of course, they're going to protect their businesses and protect what Israel does with weapons or bulldozers supplied by U.S. corporations. That was the first case. The second case is the one that concluded on August 28th, last month. It was brought by the Coreys, and it was brought against Israel for Rachel Corey's killing, a negligent killing, they said. They said it was pretty clear, or very clear, and there was lots of evidence that the bulldozer driver or others on the scene saw Rachel Corey standing there with her bullhorn and orange jacket and nonetheless rolled over her. We didn't know really what the court decision would be. There was lots of speculation, most of it, of course, people feeling, the Coreys as well, I think, that Israel would continue to assert and that through the court that it had impunity for these crimes, that you couldn't sue it. In fact, of course, that is what the judge decided in a terrible decision. He said that while Rachel Corey was in a war zone and essentially Israel could do whatever it wanted to Rachel Corey once she went into the war zone, and because she was in the war zone, she was 100% contributory negligent. In other words, it was her fault. So let's just unpack that for a second. These were civilian houses in Gaza. This was not a war zone only by the Israeli definition.
There was no shooting going on there. She was standing in front of a bulldozer. No Israeli defense forces were in any jeopardy, yet the bulldozer went over her. And to say she was 100% her fault for entering the war zone when she's standing there in an orange jacket with a bullhorn makes a mockery of any system of justice. It was very clear it was a political decision. Rachel Corrie's family was in Israel for the verdict. They had been there for much of the trial, which has been going on for 2 years. Here is Rachel Corrie's mother speaking shortly after she heard the verdict in her daughter's case.
We are, of course, deeply saddened and deeply troubled by what we heard today from Judge Oded Gershon in the Haifa District Court. I believe that this was a bad day, not only for our family, but a bad day for human rights, for humanity, for the rule of law, and also for the country of Israel.
That was Cindy Corrie, Rachel Corrie's mother, on the day of the verdict. She went on to say that, quote, it is clear that the legal system protects soldiers and provides them with legal impunity at the cost of civilians, end quote. The Corries, importantly, are sensitive, very sensitive, to the issue of how many Palestinians have been killed, Palestinians that their daughter was trying to protect. And in fact, as they traveled around Israel, talking about Rachel Corrie, they always carried with them not a picture of Rachel Corrie, but a picture of a six-year-old boy who was in the house that Rachel Corrie was trying to protect. They also wanted the trial to focus on the fact of the number of Palestinians killed in the same period, roughly the same period, when Rachel Corrie was protesting house demolitions. The lawyer for Rachel Corrie during the trial asked the Israeli brigade commander how many Palestinians had been killed between August 2002 and March 2003. This is the brigade commander for the southern command, which is Gaza. Of course, the State of Israel objected, saying, what's the relevance of that? This is about supposedly negligence in killing Rachel Corrie, etc. And then the lawyer for Rachel Corrie replied, and this is a statistic it's important to remember, that in the Rafah area alone, that's where Rachel Corrie was engaging in her protest, 101 people were killed, Palestinians, including 42 children aged 10 to 18. Those are the people Rachel Corrie was trying to protect. Those are the people and the violence Rachel Corrie sacrificed her life for, putting her body between the oppressors, the Israelis, and the oppressed, the Palestinians. The family says there will be an appeal of the case, but let's be honest, Israeli courts do not give out justice when it comes to Palestinians or those who support them. For more information about Rachel Corrie and their struggle for justice on behalf of Rachel and all Palestinians, you can go to their website, rachelcorriefoundation.org. That's RachelCorrie foundation.org. I wonder if any of our listeners were surprised or shocked to see that the Republicans invited Cardinal Timothy M. Dolan of New York, and he gave, last week, the closing prayer at the Republican National Convention in Florida. Cardinal Dolan, of course, is well known as a conservative. He's an opponent of abortion, same-sex marriage. He's suing the Obama administration over its contraception health care mandate. So he's a conservative. But he's also more than that. He's also someone who the Center for Constitutional Rights has accused of being part of the cover-up of the sexual abuse scandal when he was a bishop in Milwaukee. So here you have the Republicans having invited not just a conservative, which fits their agenda to a large extent, but a man who actually has been implicated in the cover-up of the sexual abuse scandal. Here's how. There were priests within his parish or within his area in Milwaukee who were accused of sexual abuse regarding young people under their charge. Rather than report them to the police, Cardinal Dolan approved payoffs to those priests, that's what I'll call them, payoffs of up to $20,000 if they would at least voluntarily agree to leave the priesthood. Some of them he transferred around first, but eventually those priests got up to $20,000 if they willingly left the priesthood. That sounds, well, they should leave, of course. But of course, none of them were reported to the police. They were just essentially given $20,000 after abusing all of these young people.
So, of course, perhaps many of you have been wondering, what's the point of this segment? We always understand that the Republicans are going to choose someone like Cardinal Dolan to pray at the end of their convention. He fits all their values, anti-abortion, anti-gay marriage, suing Obama for Medicare, etc. He probably doesn't fit their value of protecting pedophiles or paying off pedophiles. But they have him anyway. But the real kicker here, the real shocker, the real reason we wanted to bring you this short segment on Cardinal Dolan, our New York City cardinal, lauded throughout the United States as the most important Catholic there is, the reason we wanted to bring you this is because it's one thing for the Republicans, but guess what you'll hear this week? You're going to hear Cardinal Dolan, yes, the same cardinal, anti-abortion, anti-gay marriage, pay off the priest Dolan, close the Democratic convention. So it's not just the Republicans, but it's the Democrats as well. So there you have it, the Democrats and the Republicans, two wings of the same bird, particularly when it comes to Cardinal Dolan. Sure, the Democrats are not anti-abortion. They're perhaps mixed about gay marriage, although their platform is positive on gay marriage. But despite that, they have Cardinal Dolan give the closing prayer. Cardinal Dolan, who doesn't stand for any of their values, and worse still, is a person who has never been held accountable for covering up priestly abuse when he was the bishop or the archbishop of Milwaukee.
For more information about the heinous activities of Cardinal Dolan, you can go to the center's website, ccr.org. The Nation magazine has done us all an important service. They published a double issue titled Islamophobia, Anatomy of an American Panic. It contains as many as a dozen articles about Islamophobia. Today on Law and Disorder, we're going to talk to three of the people involved in that issue. Lizzie Ratner, who was one of the editors of the issue at The Nation, Mustafa Bayoumi, who wrote an article in the magazine called Fear and Loathing of Islam. He is also the author of a book, How Does It Feel to Be a Problem? Being Young and Arab in America, that has won the American Book Award and the Arab American Book Award for Nonfiction. He is an associate professor at Brooklyn College. We'll also speak with Deepa Kumar, who also wrote an article for the Islamophobia issue called Islamophobia, a Bipartisan Project. She's also the author of a new book, Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire. She's an associate professor of media studies and Middle East studies at Rutgers University. We bring you this timely issue in the wake of a renewed string of anti-Islam attacks that have threatened U.S. Muslims during Ramadan. Just to give you a few examples, a mosque's welcome sign was smashed. A mosque was burned to the ground in Joplin, Missouri. Pig legs were thrown into a mosque site. Shots were fired on a mosque. Molotov cocktail was thrown into a Muslim home, and hate graffiti was painted in a Muslim cemetery. These tragic events, including, of course, the murders at the Sikh temple in Oak Creek, the number of mosques attacked in Rhode Island, Southern California, Oklahoma City, and Dearborn, Michigan, mark another wave of existential Muslim threats, inciting fear and violence against Middle Eastern people, while helping to justify the ongoing war on terror. We go now to talk with Lizzie Ratner, one of the editors of the Islamophobia issue of The Nation. She's also a co-editor of the book, The Goldstone Report, The Legacy of the Landmark Investigation of the Gaza Conflict. Lizzie, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Michael. It's great to be on.
Now, Lizzie, we want to talk to you today about a double issue of The Nation magazine, and it's a special issue. It's called Islamophobia, Anatomy of an American Panic. And it has a half a dozen or more articles. It has some in the hard copy and some online. And it's an entire, really, double issue on Islamophobia. First, I'd like you to tell our listeners where they can go to look at the many articles that are in the magazine, and then give us some sense of why you, as one of the editors, thought about doing this and some sense of what's in it.
Well, first of all, thanks so much for covering this topic, because it's enormously important, and it's more important now so than ever, and I'll get to the reason why in a moment. But so yes, The Nation did a special issue about Islamophobia, and it came out at the beginning of July, and you can still find the majority of articles online at thenation.com. And there's actually about a dozen articles by a fantastic roster of authors: Mustafa Bayoumi, brilliant academic and writer, Leila Alarian, Ramzi Kassem, who's a fantastic lawyer in New York City, who wrote about the NYPD's spying on the Muslim community in New York City and, of course, beyond. Max Blumenthal, who wrote a fantastic investigative piece on Nina Rosenwald, who is an heiress who is behind an effort that's really linking far right-wing Zionism with the Islamophobia sort of anti-Muslim movement here in this country.
Can you tell us what brought you, as one of the editors in The Nation, to really decide to focus on this issue right now?
Well, the real credit has to go to the civil rights attorney, Abdine Jabara, who came to me and others about a year ago and said, you must focus in on this issue of anti-Muslim and anti-Arab bigotry, this issue that's kind of come under the rubric of Islamophobia, because it is pervasive, it's pernicious, and it's not getting enough attention. And so the idea came about that we would pitch it to The Nation, because The Nation has enormous reach, obviously, and we thought it would be a hugely important statement for a magazine to dedicate a whole issue to this one topic, despite a few kind of aberrant moments. For the most part, the left and progressives have not actually been very outspoken about the bigotry that Muslims and Arabs are facing in this country. People have stood in solidarity occasionally around issues like Part 51, but really, the left has been too quiet. And so we thought it was an incredibly important statement that a magazine like The Nation pulled together an entire issue dedicated to chronicling the incredibly comprehensive and historic nature of the current assault on Muslims and Arabs within our country. So here, you know, we see the right, as well as Democrats, frankly, using the specter of Islamophobia to organize their base, to distract from economic issues, to distract from the recession and the serious problem of joblessness. Islamophobia serves an imperial and international issue. It's no coincidence that Islamophobia has flourished at a time when our country has invaded a number of countries in the Middle East and is making war on Iraq, Afghanistan, and carrying on various proxy and drone wars throughout the area. And so obviously Islamophobia serves to kind of feed the war machine and engender support for this enterprise.
We want to thank you. It's too short of time to get everything, but we want you to again just mention where people can go online and get these 12 articles or so that make up the special issue of The Nation, Islamophobia, Anatomy of an American Panic. How can they get that?
Yes, readers, interested readers, go to thenation.com, and you can find, I believe, pretty much all dozen or so articles that cover everything from the FBI's trumped-up sting operations, to the media's history of stereotyping Muslims, to the NYPD's spying scandal, and on and on. So I urge readers to check it out.
Lizzie Ratner, thank you very much for your role in organizing this special issue, The Nation. Crucially important. We applaud you for your good work, and thanks for being on Law & Disorder.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Thank you, guys.
We talk now with Mustafa Bayoumi, who wrote an article in the magazine called Fear and Loathing of Islam. He is also the author of a book, How Does It Feel to Be a Problem? Being Young and Arab in America. Mustafa Bayoumi, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Mustafa, you were, I think, one of the editors as well as a writer of the special nation double issue on Islamophobia, Anatomy of an American Panic. Your article in that magazine is called Fear and Loathing of Islam. Why don't you give us some sense of your article and then some of the bigger picture?
Sure. I'm happy to do so. You know, I think that Islamophobia is becoming a bigger and bigger problem in the country. And I was happy to see the nation was willing to take on the question for a double issue. And one of the things that I think is really important to understand, too, is that there's been a shift over these last 10 years, a shift from a paranoia around security to a paranoia just about the basic facts of Muslim life in the United States. In a way, you could say it's a shift from security to culture. So even just things like building a mosque or, you know, having Muslims go through a divorce invokes creeping Sharia, or, you know, organizing a school, an Arabic English dual language high school in, you know, in New York City, because you have the charges of a madrasa, having assigning certain books to be read in schools in order to educate the population becomes the charge of indoctrination. At every stage, anything that has to do with the basic daily concerns about living a life as a Muslim American somehow now becomes charged with sedition. And I think that that's a real problem.
Yeah, no, I think your article was really enlightening for me on that issue. I mean, we cover a lot here, you know, informants going into Muslim communities and trying to create cases against Muslims and all that, you know, the so-called security issues. But what your article, of course, it uses the word that I only know that well, which means everyday, common. And that's what it really talks about. Can you say why you think that occurred? Why it went from being around security and looking at Muslims as making a security problem, which, of course, is way over-exaggerated when you look at the statistics, and you can talk about that, but how it moved from what you call security into culture?
Yeah, sure. You're absolutely right that it is way over-exaggerated, the security questions. And, you know, even if you look at just any measure of the statistics, you can see that. Just to give you one example, over the last 10 years, people who do crunch the numbers have found that the number of people involved in terrorism cases in the United States from the Muslim community, that's about 6% of the total over the last 10 years. And so it's maybe 100 plus people who have been involved in some kind of terrorism prosecution in the United States. And many of those from the Muslim side have also been due to the dubious use of spies and informants within the communities.
That's out of a population of 3 million. We're talking about 100 people. And some of those are dubious.
Exactly. Exactly right. But then you have this shift, as you're asking, this shift from security to culture. And I think that there's a couple of reasons for it. One is, before 9/11, most people in the United States, most Americans, had very little idea, I think, about Muslims in general and Muslims in the United States. So it takes a while for a narrative to get hold in the country. And so this narrative, it has been pre-existing in other places, but it hadn't existed in the United States before, that there are Muslims here and there are Muslims here who are going to do something terrible. So I think that that narrative has grown partly due to the fact that it didn't really exist prior to 9/11.
I think that's true. I think there was complete ignorance about it. I remember right after 9/11, people didn't know anything about being Muslim at all. And we had a good friend, you probably know, Abdin Jabara, who went around talking about what it means, what does jihad mean, what does it mean to be Muslim. And no one, even on the left, had any idea.
Yes, I think that that's absolutely true. The other side of it, though, I think also has to do with the nature of politics in the country. And it seems to me that when the Bush administration was in charge and you had a regime that was basically hostile to all things Muslim and a very war-oriented, aggressive regime that spoke that sort of ideology, you didn't have the opportunity for a populist narrative to take hold because, in a sense, Bush was doing that for people on the right in this country. But after the Bush regime is over, and now you get the Obama regime, you get this growth, this extreme growth of this narrative. And you see it coming from very, very strong quarters within the conservative movement.
Mustafa, along those lines of who's funding this panic attack, Lizzie Ratner mentioned one name, Nina Rosenwald. I remember when I was living in Chicago going to the Rosenwald Museum of Science and Industry. Rosenwald had founded Sears Roebuck and was one of the owners of a fabulous fortune and a charitable man. Is Nina Rosenwald part of that?
Oh, absolutely. We have an excellent article by Max Blumenthal in the issue. It's all available online, by the way, so people should check it out if they have the chance. But absolutely, Max details in extraordinary precision the ways in which she's funding this. And, you know, part of the funding to the anti-Muslim movement in the United States is basic conservative politics, extreme conservative politics in the country. And part of it is also due essentially to the Israel-Palestine conflict. And so people who want to come on to the on board of Israel want to make a very distorted picture of what Muslim life is like because they see that as being in their interest. And so you see that it's actually a refraction of another politics finding its way into the American political sphere.
Let's talk about the appearance of these chauvinist, racist ads, both in San Francisco and now in Metro North, that go after Muslims and Arabs. What's your take on that?
I think it just is yet another illustration of the ways in which this kind of crazy ideology is basically normalized within American society. And I think that that's really, really a problem. I think that there's really no other community who can be so easily maligned and so easily put under the lens than Muslims and Arabs in the United States today.
I want to go back to what you're saying is the normalization of Islamophobia. And I know in your article, which is called Fear and Loathing of Islam, in the double issue of The Nation on Islamophobia, you talk about various aspects of the New York Police Department and what they did. And, of course, we're sitting here looking at it as it's completely crazy what they did. And it just seems like we shouldn't have the same police commissioner anymore. But there's a number of steps you go through that they did. One of them is the article, Radicalization in the West, the Homegrown Threat. Another is the movie The Third Jihad. Why don't you talk about what went on in New York with the police department, what the reaction was, and what the results seemed to be?
Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, the police department in New York has now a decade-long history of really othering the American Muslim community in really dangerous ways. And they, I think, are one of the primary actors in this idea of making the quotidian, this daily life, suspicious for the rest of the country. One of the ways that they did that was by releasing a report back in 2007 called Radicalization in the West, which is really poorly sourced and was hardly an academic report at all, based on a few anecdotal reports from newspapers and things like that. In which they said, basically, that places of ordinary life are what they called terrorism incubators. Not only that, but then it's also from this idea that we then found out that the police department had been screening this film called The Third Jihad for its new recruits, which was, again, funded by the same Islamophobic network that we were just talking about.
Tell us about the film. Our audience won't believe it.
I mean, it's just a crazy film that's basically saying that all of the Muslims in the United States are here as a fifth column and are ready to pounce, you know, at the drop of the Quran to usurp the Constitution. And it's full of ominous music and all kinds of terrible imagery. And it's a total fabrication. It's a fiction.
And the police are showing this to other... it's a training film.
It's a training film.
New York City.
That's right. It's a training film for new recruits. And so you have a problem in training and in practice. And that's true not just for the NYPD. It's also true for the Pentagon. And it's true for the FBI as well. But in the case of the NYPD, then now we've since found out what's been confirmed through a series of reports by the Associated Press, which won the Pulitzer Prize for this series, is that the NYPD has also been involved in racial, ethnic, and religious profiling of the Muslim American community in New York City. And so they would do things like send out what they called rakers and undercover officers and such things into all of the mosques in the city. They would take down the names of people just by the virtue of them visiting these mosques and looking at license plate numbers. They were visiting restaurants where people ate. They were listening to whether or not they had Al Jazeera on the television. They went to barber shops. They went to university clubs. All of this, by the way, without a hint of any wrongdoing, and they created these massive maps, mapping the whole city from its ethnic and demographic position. And not only is it an extreme waste of resources, but now we find out, because there was a deposition that was recently released, that this extraordinary effort by the New York City Police Department resulted in how many investigations? Absolutely zero. Zero investigations came out of this effort. It's in a colossal waste of resources, and it illustrates the racially oriented mindset, actually, of the NYPD.
And that's 6 years of investigations, right?
At least 6 years. That it might be as many as 12.
But,
yeah.
Know, let me play devil's advocate here for a second and say maybe it's not such a waste of resources. Not if you want to deflect legitimate anger of the public for all sorts of reasons against the wrong guys. Then it's a use of resources by the 1% that's doing them some good.
I agree with that when it comes especially to the FBI investigations, because the FBI investigations were very public and they involved a lot of people coming into the communities and creating all kinds of havoc. But the NYPD program was covert. It was actually not overt. It seems to me that what was really driving the NYPD program, besides a kind of racially oriented mindset, was also just a grab for resources. You know, the amount of money that the NYPD gets from Homeland Security is enormous. It's
How much?
Enormous. It's in the tens of millions of dollars, I believe.
I think it shows that fear and prejudice works. We made the same point about why wasn't there a popular outcry against torture? Was the Bush people able to get away with that? Because to some extent, the program was popular.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think another way of thinking about this, too, is to look at the Oak Creek massacre that happened recently in Wisconsin at the Sikh temple.
Yeah.
The amount of media coverage and the amount of outrage that generated was marginal if you compare it to what happened in Aurora, Colorado, just a couple of weeks earlier. Some of that might be that there's a saturation, perhaps, but I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that your average American consumer of the media just does not relate to the victims of the Oak Creek massacre because they don't see them as being part of the American family.
The key thing in your article, as you said, is this movement from security to culture. It's an attack on Muslims, not just on security issues, but on culture as well. Well, Mustafa, thank you very much for writing, for being here, and talking with us about your article and your book.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
We talk now with Deepa Kumar, who also wrote an article for the Islamophobia issue called Islamophobia, a Bipartisan Project. She's an associate professor of media studies and Middle East studies at Rutgers University. Deepa Kumar, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Deepa, we have you here for a lot of reasons. One is the article we're going to discuss in The Nation, the special issue on Islamophobia. And the other is your book, Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire. But your Nation article in the special issue is called Islamophobia, a Bipartisan Project. So the first thing I'd like to get from you is the title. What is meant by a bipartisan project?
Well, of late, with all of the very anti-Muslim statements coming from people like Michelle Bachmann, Joe Walsh, all of whom are Republicans, there is a sense in which it is the Republicans who are responsible for Islamophobia, for the demonization of Muslims, and so on. And so what this title tries to get at is it's not just the Republicans who have fomented this notion of the Muslim terrorist enemy that we should fight an endless war against, but in fact the Democrats too have been responsible for this language, particularly since 9/11, but certainly before that as well.
Now, I don't want to jump ahead here, but if we talk about the Democrats and Republicans, which we'll be jumping ahead a little bit, in the article you talk about the differences between the way Bush dealt with Islamophobia or the issue and Obama dealt with Islamophobia. Can you talk about those differences with us?
Certainly. In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, what you see is that people like the neocons who were in power realize that they don't actually have the language. The Pentagon doesn't have the language to take advantage, as Condoleezza Rice put it, of an event of this magnitude. And they wanted to capitalize on it. And so the question is, how were they going to respond? And so they bring in a team of academics. They bring in media personalities. And from this, this brand of the war on terror gets hatched. And part of that is really language that was developed in the 1990s called the Clash of Civilizations. And it was a man by the name of Bernard Lewis who first penned this term back in 1990 and was popularized by Samuel Huntington. Now, these people are very closely connected to the neocon circles. And what they did is they came up with this notion of the war on terror, which would be based on this idea of the Clash of Civilizations, which is that, according to Huntington, there are 7 or 8 civilizations, and the West is identified by its unique cultural traits, such as democracy, free speech, women's rights, and so on. And apparently, these values have no resonance in the Islamic civilization, and so there was bound to be a clash. And so what you see is that language gets used, for instance, in the Afghan war, in relation to Afghan women. So it's not just that we're going to, you know, carry out revenge on Osama bin Laden, but that we're going to rescue Afghan women. Or in the case of Iraq, it's about bringing democracy when no weapons of mass destruction could be found. The West, of course, being this beacon of democracy, is going to bring democracy to these savages, to these barbarians in this rhetoric. And of course, this rhetoric has a long history. It goes back to the 19th century. The idea of the white man's burden becomes the key rationale for European colonization of the Middle East and other parts of the world. So that's Bush, and that's the clash of civilization rhetoric by Bush.
Yeah, let me just say, so I understand that, and then I think the next point you that I read, which is, I guess, you're going to go to the Cairo speech, right?
Indeed.
So that's the shift is the Cairo speech, the way I read your article.
Absolutely right. In fact, actually, even before the Cairo speech, during Bush's second term, there was a sense in which the Bush agenda, the neocon agenda, was in shambles, right? They expected to go to Iraq and after that to Syria and after that to Iran, and it didn't work out that way. In fact, even former allies, old Europe, had been alienated. So Bush himself starts a process of toning down some of this rhetoric. General Petraeus would actually introduce the counterinsurgency doctrine, which is about winning hearts and minds. So there's already a softening of the rhetoric. And then there's a policy group that comes together headed by Madeleine Albright called Changing Directions in the Muslim World, in which they advise the next president to actually soften the rhetoric both in the inaugural speech, which Obama does. He talks about Muslims being part of American society, which I believe was the first time an American president
amazing.
Has ever admitted to that. And then he goes off to Cairo and pretty much carries out the advice of this policy group, which is to reject the clash of civilizations, talk about the mutual sort of cooperation between East and West, and talk about the role that various Muslim dynasties have played in strengthening medicine, in laying the basis for medicine, astronomy, and the sciences, and so on. And so that's the rhetorical shift. But in practice, of course, as we know, Obama would continue Bush's second term policies.
Right. Well, go to that for a second, and then I want to go back historically, because you do make a strong point in your article. Again, we're talking to Deepa Kumar about her article in The Nation, Islamophobia, a Bipartisan Project. You make a strong point, what a change it was when the Cairo speech happened, when this rhetoric started to change. But then you say the policies continue. And what do you mean by the policies continue?
Right. So in the case of Iraq, there was already a sense in which the Bush administration was going to pull troops out. Obama simply finishes that project, but he also tries to extend the status of forces agreement in Iraq so that he could leave more troops in Iraq and so forth. And then, of course, he escalates the war in Afghanistan. He sends 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan, and now there's an AFPAC strategy where Pakistan becomes a part of the war on terror. Also, one study showed that in 4 years of Bush, he used about 50 drone strikes. In 4 years of Obama, he's used about five times that many drone strikes.
We've been talking about post 9/11 in particular, and the Bush rhetoric versus Obama's rhetoric, and the continuation of the wars. Your article talks a lot about historically and where that came from and how it developed. But can you just give us a sense of why this isn't just a post 9/11 issue?
Absolutely. The association of Arabs with terrorism and then later Muslims with terrorism is actually a pretty, you know, drawn out process. So the idea of terrorism and terrorist enemies actually comes into the political stage globally after the Second World War. The context for this really is national liberation struggles that are raging around the world against, you know, the former colonial powers, against Britain and France and so on. And in that context, these leaders of national liberation struggle get branded as terrorists. Now, the first mainstream debate that actually happens is at the UN, at the UN General Assembly in 1972. This is after the Munich attack, where the group Black September executes Israeli athletes. And so the UN General Assembly has a conversation about terrorism. And there's a real debate. There is, on the one hand, the non-aligned countries, which argue that self-determination is a right that colonized nations should have. And so the use of force in the interests of national liberation should not be branded as terrorist. On the other hand, Europe and the West and so on say that, yes, we agree with self-determination, but force can only be used by nation states, not by individuals. So that's the context. There's no agreement. But in the United States, where there aren't colonies in the same sort of way as there are, you know, among European nations, the first entrance into the public sphere of this language is with Operation Boulder.
It was the first time in your article that I ever heard the term. I mean, we look at this stuff a lot at my office, but I never heard Operation Boulder. It's under Nixon administration.
Absolutely right.
And what is it?
Well, essentially, it gives carte blanche authority to law enforcement people to go out and interview Arabs in general to see if they have any connections to the Palestinian cause. So what is an act by a small group of people, a violent act, no doubt, now becomes a process of racial profiling where all Arabs are seen as being guilty. And so that's the first instance. And if that happens to Arabs in 1979, particularly with the Iranian Revolution and then the hostage crisis, the dragnet gets expanded to include Iranians as well. But of course, and that was Carter. But of course, it was for Ronald Reagan to introduce his counterterrorism policy and take this to a whole new level. By the time we come into 1991, George Bush Sr. has actually sanctioned all sorts of racial profiling at airports, picking up people, interviewing them, and going after not just Arabs, but also anti-war demonstrators in the context of the Gulf War of 1991. But I want to make a point, though, about how the Arab terrorist becomes the Islamic terrorist. And I think here the role of Israel actually is important to this conversation. Because initially, in 1979 and in the 1970s, the way that Israel is talking about the PLO and their enemy is as terrorists, right, as Arab terrorists. And in 1979, actually, Benjamin Netanyahu, as the head of an institute known as the Jonathan Institute, holds this conference in Jerusalem where a number of dignitaries from around the world attend this. And his father, who starts the conference, basically says, all of these terrorists around the world, whether they're IRA, whether they're PLO, and so on, claim to the mantle of self-determination and national liberation. In fact, they're just terrorists. They're like the Nazis. They're like Hitler. So you start to see the beginnings of this notion of Islamofascism. You know, the roots are sown at that conference. Now, the U.S. takes this idea. Many of the neocons are in attendance at this Jerusalem conference. And then the next conference, organized by the Jonathan Institute, is in Washington, D.C. By this point, the language has changed because the Iranian Revolution has happened and and Hamas and Hezbollah and all of these forces now start to become seen, particularly by the liquid right in Israel, as a kind of existential threat. So what was the Arab terrorist now becomes the Islamic terrorist, and that language comes to the United States, particularly in 1984, and then gets amplified, you know, in the post-Cold War period by people like Bernard Lewis, who writes this famous piece called The Roots of Muslim Rage in 1990, and that's where he introduces this term clash of civilizations.
Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire by Deepa Kumar. And the cover, it's all white, and then you have a U.S. helicopter flying over a mosque. So we're talking about how Islamophobia, that racist idea, is used to build empire. But flesh the book out. What were you trying to get across in the book, Deepa?
Right. I actually start all the way in the 11th century in the book, because the key argument that I make in the book is that the idea of this menacing Muslim enemy is not new. It is not something that was created after 9/11, but in fact, it goes back a millennium. And the crux of the argument is that elites, political elites in the West, have always relied on this image of the Muslim enemy, a particular way of demonizing Muslims, as a way to motivate ordinary people to join armies, to get angry, and to go off and kill people.
We're starting with the Crusades, right?
Indeed. And you just took the words out of my mouth. The reason I start in the 11th century is because of the Crusades. And of course, if you look at the motivation for the Crusades, it's not a religious war fundamentally. It's about the papacy wanting to establish control over Europe and unite Europe under the rule of the Vatican, right? So it was about political goals, but religious rhetoric gets used. And the same thing with the reconquest of Spain, of the Iberian Peninsula. The rulers of Europe, you know, are saying this is about getting rid of the Muslims, and of course they get rid of the Jews as well. But in reality, it's about taking back their lands, taking back power into their own hands. So these are always political struggles that get painted in religious colors.
Although, fast forward 1,000 years, and you've got Bush Jr. calling his efforts in the Middle East a crusade. But talk further about your wonderful new book. Tell the audience how you bring it up to date about what's going on now with the use of Islamophobia.
Absolutely. Just one more quick point about that early moment, and that is that it has not been the case that the East and the West have always clashed. I think that's important, and I take great pains to show that this Islamophobic rhetoric is one that's mobilized by the elite, but not necessarily one that ordinary people have always bought into. And so you have large chunks of time in the encounter between the East and the West where people have had not only cordial relations, but even mutual respect. And in fact, Europe or the Middle East would not look the same had it not been for this intermingling of people. So I think that's important to say that. But to come to the present, of late, over the last few weeks, we have seen an escalation of attacks against Muslims in this country. And, you know, it doesn't come out of nowhere. People point the finger at neo-Nazi groups, people like Wade Page, who was responsible for the Oak Creek shootings in Wisconsin. And yes, it's true, the Southern Poverty Law Center has said that there has been a dramatic 69% increase in the number of hate groups since 2000. It's true that these forces, there is an organized Islamophobic network that has about $43 million invested into this kind of demonization. All that is true. We should take these people seriously, the people who are running the bus ads, for instance, in San Francisco as well as in New York, out and out racist attacks on Muslims. But I think we've got to recognize the context from which the far right actually gets the courage to do what it does. And this is where I hold both Republicans and Democrats responsible. So we have the Bachmans, who are talking about, you know, Muslim Brotherhood infiltration in the government. We have Joe Walsh, the Illinois Republican, who said there's a radical strain of Islam in America and they're out to kill Americans. And not so coincidentally, in Illinois, there's a shooting outside a mosque. There is a chemical bomb, a homemade chemical bomb thrown at a school and so on. In other words, the groundwork for this kind of rabid attacks, you know, a Muslim gravesite was actually desecrated in California. There were pig's legs that were thrown at the proposed site of an Islamic center. these rabid right-wingers actually get their confidence from mainstream figures like Walsh, like Bachman and others actually, you know, coming out and saying things like this. And the sad reality is that the Democrats have done nothing to actually counter this.
Well, you know, more than that, they're conducting wars against Islamic countries, legitimizing people of that faith here in the United States.
That's exactly right. And in Afghanistan recently, when a couple of U.S. soldiers were killed, Jay Carney comes out and says, well, we have to continue to stay in Afghanistan because of Al-Qaeda. And so that's the use of Islamophobia. It's this menacing threat that apparently is so big that we have to use the world's greatest military to go after them. And just one statistic on this in terms of the supposed threat posed by Muslims in the United States. You know, the Associated Press just this past week revealed that after 6 years of the NYPD spying program on Muslim Americans in the Northeast, there has not been one link between a Muslim American and terrorism. 6 years. Think of all the resources that have been put into that, right? And then you put that together with a comprehensive study that was done by the Triangle Center in North Carolina. And they found that in the 10 years since 9/11, 11 Muslim Americans were responsible for the deaths of 33 other people. Let's put that in context. There have been 150,000 murders in the United States during that period. 33 is the figure that Muslim Americans are responsible for. And even globally, you know, for those who are skeptics who say, oh, just that's because the legal apparatus is doing its job. Well, actually, no, because even internationally, the figures are actually the same, in fact, lower, which is the last year that the State Department figures are available. A grand total of 15 American civilians were killed worldwide due to terrorism, 1/5, of which all but two took place in Afghanistan. And so the fear-mongering, particularly the bus ads that we're seeing and the subway ads we're seeing in New York City right now, which says some 20,000 killed, what have you, we have to question where they get these figures from, because in reality, the threat is a manufactured threat. It's a spectacle that gets put before our eyes to keep us scared and paranoid.
We're talking to Deepa Kumar, who wrote an important article in the special Nation issue on Islamophobia called Islamophobia, a Bipartisan Project. We're talking about that article as well as her new book, Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire. Incredibly well written. But I just turned to the last chapter, Fighting Islamophobia. And this is, of course, What Can We Do About It? And it opens with this great line, and this will give you some of the sense of the scope of the book. In this book, we have journeyed from the 7th century to the 21st. So you're talking about a broad scope of a book. And it also talks about what you just hinted at or said in terms of how to fight Islamophobia. You say, quote, the Democratic Party is not an ally in this fight. So you've talked about that, but who are the allies and how do we make the fight?
I think the first thing to be said is that Islamophobia is not about religion. It's about politics. It's about the use of this particular image of the Muslim enemy by politicians to wage the war on terror. So we have to take this on in terms of building a political movement, a social movement that actually addresses these racist attitudes in our society. So I take inspiration, for instance, from two movements in the 1960s. On the one hand, the civil rights movement, and on the other, the anti-war movement. And I think the two strategies need to come together in the case of fighting Islamophobia. That is, on the one hand, there is this well-funded Islamophobic network that goes around putting out the kind of ads that we've seen in San Francisco, as well as in New York City and so on. They are going to continue to do these things. They have been attacking mosques. They have been attacking proposed community centers. They've been doing this for the last 10-some years. You know, these are the people who are associated with the so-called Ground Zero mosque controversy. They're going to do this because they actually benefit from this kind of rhetoric. And so I think on the one hand, everywhere where they show up, progressives, leftists, liberals need to come out and actually say, you are not welcome here. And that's what we did right here in New York City. We built a grassroots movement. We got rid of those people. Park 51 was actually constructed earlier this year. On the other hand, we can't simply fight the right, because we do have to understand that this rhetoric is amplified in the mainstream, right? If this new right, I'm calling them the new McCarthyites, right? Because they play that function. They push the envelope. It's the mainstream from which they actually get the wind beneath their wings. So we have to look at where does Islamophobia come from and why the elite, the political elite, need it in this country. It is to justify the war on terror, whether these are actual wars in Afghanistan or Iraq, or now this really controversial process of drone strikes all over the country, violating the national sovereignty rights of countries around the world. How do you do that? You do that by saying there are all these evil people everywhere, so give me carte blanche authority. And so we have to both take on the far right, and we have to challenge the priorities of empire. We have to challenge the priorities of the war on terror and bring together a multiracial coalition that can actually change an entire generation. I think this is where the civil rights movement is so illustrative. It took people sitting in, it took people speaking out before we could go from a situation where 90% of Americans didn't want an African American as a neighbor to the exact opposite today. And today we have 50, 60% of Americans who don't want to have anything to do with Muslims. How do we change that attitude? We change it with a social movement that can actually impact an entire generation.
I was reading the Times and I came across this statistic that in the last 27 months in Afghanistan, I read that 1,000 American soldiers have been killed, which is the equivalent of how many American soldiers were killed in the 9 years before. So really, under Obama, we've seen 2.5 years or less, more people or as many people killed as under 8 years of President Bush.
President Obama is excellent rhetorically. He's a very sophisticated speaker. And as you said, Michael, he doesn't use words like Bush's crusades. You know, he's not that stupid. And so in that sense, he presents a very sophisticated image. But that was his role, isn't it? The reason he got the blessing of, you know, Wall Street to come to power is precisely to rehabilitate the image of empire, right? If Bush had dragged the American image into the mud around the world, he was here to rehabilitate that image, and he's done that brilliantly. But both internationally, you know, you spoke to the number of U.S. soldiers who've been killed. Let's talk about the number of innocent people who've been killed in Afghanistan due to the drone strikes and so on. You know, we're talking about thousands of people. But even domestically, you know, you look at Obama's policies. He said he would shut down Guantanamo. He said he would end torture. He has done nothing of that sort. If anything, he's actually taken some Bush-era policies, like indefinite detention, and made it law. The NDAA actually allows American citizens to be indefinitely detained, right? Obama's counter-radicalization strategy, for instance, talks about an informer network, like, you know, coaches, teachers, and so on, informing on each other. This is McCarthyism. But when Peter King has his radicalization hearing, he is rightfully called a McCarthyite. But when Obama does the same thing, there's not a peep, because he's our guy, he's a liberal, and so on. So in other words, there's a way in which the Democratic Party is able to get away with so much more because it has this image in the public eye. And the last thing I'll say is, you know, you asked me for the long trajectory of terrorism policy in the U.S. I failed to mention Clinton. In fact, it was President Clinton who really took it a whole nother step with his Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996, which, among other things, made it legal to actually deport people with secret evidence. And of course, we know this lays the basis for the Patriot Act and so forth. So this has really been a bipartisan project in the interests of empire, in the interests of imperialism.
Well, I can't imagine having it better said. So in your article and in your book, again, the name of the book?
Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire by Deepa Kumar. The book party is September 6th, 16 Beaver Street, 7 o'clock.
16 Beaver Street is what organization?
The Alwan Center for the Arts.
It's up on the second or third floor. Come over. 16 Beaver Street is way downtown, south of Wall Street. We'd be very happy to see you. Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire. Deepa Kumar, thank you very much for being on Law & Disorder.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
If you want to hear Law & Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law & Disorder Radio on Facebook.